Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Commodity Classics, one of my favorite things to talk about. In fact, if we look to the end of February, the beginning of March, when the best and brightest farmers are coming together to see the latest and greatest technology.
Kurt Blades with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
This year it's going to be in Denver, and we're starting on a Sunday with some great programming, and then Monday and Tuesday with a fantastic trade show. Registration is going to be opening up very soon, and I encourage all of your listeners and viewers to make plans to attend Commodity Classic. If you've never attended in the past, be amazed at how great of a community you'll find there of like-minded farming business professionals to be a part of this conversation when things are actually happening, to look toward the future and see how we're making a difference in the world.
In this heat, you're concerned about both the health of your animals and their performance. Strobel Super Shades can reduce the dangerous ground temperatures 30 degrees or more. Strobel Super Shades, the best-built cattle shades in the industry, available in 40 by 40 with 1,600 square feet of shade or 20 by 20, proven to protect your cattle and increase your gains. Go to StrobelShades.com for more. StrobelShades.com.
This is Agriculture Today.
The cotton industry has, in the entire really global textile market, has been facing a lot of headwinds over the recent years.
William Kimbrell is Chief Operating Officer with Cotton Incorporated.
Overall economic growth has been slower than normal. This tends to be one of the main drivers for personal income and then dispensable spending as well. So this is a big factor in what drives imports and purchases of cotton textiles. So you can see the chart on the right is really showing a long-term look at finished textile products, cotton products that are being imported into the United States. And you can see, you know, obviously a trend that changes quite a bit year to year, early from 2002 into before the financial crisis. We had some good steady growth. A lot of this was fueled by U.S. economy, but also onboarding of China as well. China was experiencing a lot of growth at that period. Then we had two kind of downfalls there, looking at the financial crisis in 2009 and then the spike of cotton prices as well, which led to a lot of share erosion. And then we had kind of a prolonged recovery. And then more recently, in the most recent years, we've really experienced a series of shocks, which, you know, they've come on so quickly and there've been so many so frequently that it's been tough to kind of level set and restart some things. But that started in 2019 when we had the trade dispute with China. New tariffs were imposed on China. Those are still continuing today. That was quickly followed by COVID, in which the market completely fell off. Imports completely dropped. You know, global economies around the world were shut down. And then everything came roaring back. We had the stimulus inside of the United States, significant amount of stimulus through several tranches that sent consumer spending through the roof on both goods and a little bit less on the services because people weren't able to get out and go to restaurants. But, you know, we had a huge spending surge and that sent imports up. Then that was followed by the shipping crisis, which led to record inflation. We had the war in Europe and then interest rates to try and, reset the economy. And in looking at those, as that period, you know, over the past 4 or 5 years has changed, you know, we had that big spike on the rush to get consumer goods when we had all the stimulus coming into the United States and people spending a lot of money on durable goods. And then the shipping crisis, which sent the inflation rates up, and then the, you know, economy or the U.S. governments and other major governments rising interest rates really led to about a 7 million bale drop in imports of cotton products. So a lot of that we attributed to some over inventories and companies needing to bring down inventories to a more reasonable level. But also there was the issue around de minimis, which I'll touch on here shortly. And I do want to make sure to communicate that, you know, while the first chart is about cotton textiles coming into the U.S., it's not just a cotton issue. It is a global textile issue. And here you can see similar trend with imports into U.S., textile imports into the U.S. for all fibers. So a very, very similar trend there, impacting cotton, but also impacting the entire global textile industry.
And what about fiber demand?
Overall, looking at fiber demand, you know, we're hoping that we've kind of seen a trough, bottom with the global economy. Inventories, we have seen them stabilize over the past year or so. I think that brands and retailers have figured out the right level of inventory. We've seen interest rates, the shock of those have already come in, hoping to see some of those go down. So hopefully a lot of the headwinds kind of on the global economics perspective have slowed down a little bit, and we're going to start to see some tailwinds to help us out going in the future.
This is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The ag market's a little tough right now.
Kurt Blades is with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
And that's reflected in the tractor and combine sales. In fact, for the month of July, we're down about 15% by where we were this time last year for the month of July. And we're about 13% down year to date compared to where we were this time last year. So it's not all great news right now, as many of your farmer listeners will say, that they're under a lot of pressure right now.
But numbers during the pandemic really skewed the averages.
That's an incredibly relevant point when you look at the month-to-month data and the year-over-year data. It's because, you know, 1 month does not a trend make. And as you correctly said, during the pandemic, we saw dramatic growth in tractors and combine sales. So we're comparing numbers off of what were really high numbers to begin with. So to see these declines, obviously that causes some concerns, but it's also, we're coming off of some high numbers. So when you look at the long-term view of agriculture, looking back 5 years or looking ahead 5 years, there's still lots of room for optimism. However, you know, right now we're dealing with, you know, kind of, you know, a lot of uncertainty in the ag market, and that's reflected in the capital market, in the capital equipment market specifically.
And what are the challenges for the industry?
The number one thing is going to be commodity prices. If we're selling, you know, corn and soybeans today that are right at or below the cost of production, that's a real problem. But then you have to go into what's leading to some of those things. Obviously, there's some dark storm clouds out there, whether it's trade issues, whether it's global, you know, politics that are figuring into it, whether it's uncertainty in the biofuels market, the lack of a farm bill, interest rates. You can just kind of go through a whole lot of factors that are leading to, you know, sort of that malaise that the farm community might be feeling right now. Couple that with maybe some of the demand was met during the pandemic when times were a little bit better. So, you know, maybe the fleet can stand another year. So all of these things kind of combine to these numbers showing up. But I'll tell you what, I'm a farm kid, and I just drove through Nebraska and through Missouri earlier in the week, and there are beautiful crops in the field. And nothing puts a smile on a farm kid's face more, or a farmer that is planting their fields more, than harvesting a bountiful crop. And it looks like we're going to have a great crop. It would be great if those commodity prices were a little bit higher, but that does absolutely affect the psyche of farmers, and we fully expect that to be reflected in the markets in the coming months.
Coupled with uncertainty dealing with tax policy.
It absolutely has been. I mean, I'm sitting here in Des Moines, Iowa today, where the House Ways and Means Committee is actually just down the street at the Iowa State Fair doing a listening session specifically on those topics. Our association and others in the industry are very keenly, you know, paying attention to these concerns. There's some stuff set to expire that many farm businesses take, you know, significant advantage of, as well as the manufacturers taking a lot of advantage of, and the dealers. So if at the end of the day, all these are ran as businesses, and that tax burden does become part of that factor, whether it's a decision to operate in a certain state or a certain region, or, you know, the ability for a machine to be sold at a certain price. The taxes are part of that. So, you know, I applaud the Ways and Means Committee for listening to farmers here in the Midwest to hear those stories loud and clear. And we'll see what comes out of that. But boy, add that to that uncertainty list that I rattled off before. Some of those storm clouds, that's on the list as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In the lifetime of most of the people in this room, not everybody, but most of the people in this room, we've lost 544,970 farms since 1981 when Bob Berglund, who was the Secretary of Agriculture, was leaving and said, you know, I'm concerned that this focus on production and focus on larger commercial operations and larger farms is going to have its impact on rural communities and farm families.
Speaking last week in Omaha at the American Coalition for Ethanol's 37th annual conference, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Now, to give you a sense of how many farm families that are no longer in business, that's the same number, relatively speaking, of all the farmers today that are farming in North Dakota and South Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa and Nebraska and Colorado, Oklahoma and Missouri. One out of every six farm families that was in business in 1981 is gone. In addition to the farm families are gone, 151 million acres of land that was in farming is no longer in farming, no longer available for farming. Want to know why land prices are what they are? In part, it's because the supply has shrunk. You want to know how much land that is? That is the landmass of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Maryland, and most of Virginia combined in the lifetime of the folks in this room. And we've got to ask ourselves as a country and as rural Americans, are we okay with that? As if you are, then we can continue to have policies that will generate, continue to make choices that will essentially give a farm families an option of either getting big or ultimately getting out. Seems to me there's a better choice. Recognizing the importance of production agriculture and continuing to support that, as we should, and we are. But also recognizing that there needs to be ways in which that farm family can generate more than one check, if you will, from what's done on the farm. 88% of farm families today work multiple jobs. They work on the farm and then they work off the farm. Why is it that the farm family has to work multiple jobs? Why can't the farm generate multiple sources of income? You all have figured this out. You all are part of the solution. We just need to do more of this. And that's why climate smart agriculture and its ability to convert agricultural production into something more valuable creates new market opportunities. It's why measuring and quantifying and verifying what you do matters, because then you can sell it to ecosystem service markets that will pay you for the environmental results that only you as farmers can get. That's why it's important for us to continue to look for creative ways not only to have production agriculture and produce crops, but also utilize the ability of farms to generate renewable energy that lowers costs for you and for the folks in your communities. It's why it's important to create local and regional food systems that create a better deal for the farmer. So instead of 20 cents of every food dollar at a grocery store you get 50 or 75 cents of every food dollar. It's why it's important to look for ways in which farmers can receive income for the use of their land that in turn makes it easier for them to participate in new industries like sustainable aviation fuel. This is a new industry. This is the beginning of a new economy for America that creates real opportunity. So you folks are really important, which is why I flew in here at 11 o'clock last night to be with you this morning, because I want to thank you and I want to encourage you to continue what you're doing, and I want to continue to be a partner.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Minimus is a concern of ours at Cotton Incorporated because several reasons, mainly around the implications to our budget.
William Kimbrell is COO of Cotton Incorporated.
If you haven't heard of de minimis is shipments that are coming into the United States from overseas that are below a threshold of $800. These shipments are able to come into the United States without being subject to any tariffs or duties. So they, in a way, come in through a channel that is not as restrictive as traditional imports. And why companies and organizations are leveraging this channel is because it's a lower risk model and also a lower cost model. So there's a lot of opportunity there to reach U.S. consumers directly. These are very small orders that can typically are shipped by air, so there's a lot of reduced lead time. As I mentioned, they're not going through the traditional channels that most imports are, so logistics, managing the logistics is a lot more, it's a lot easier, a lot more simple. There's less scrutiny at customs because they are falling below this $800 threshold, and as I mentioned, there are no tariffs.
Are the Chinese using de minimis?
de minimis into the United States is trying to mimic Chinese strategy in China. They have a lot of direct from manufacturer to consumer. So it's a way to tap into a new opportunity, a new way to conduct business inside of the United States. From Cotton Incorporated's perspective, where we see some problems with this is de minimis imports right now are not they're not assessed at customs. So the volume that comes in, the collections will be down, and we are already seeing that they are down. So there are long-term implications if there's not a fix to this. There's also concern over some erosion or share erosion because of cotton tends to have a tariff advantage over synthetic products. On the right side, you can see tariff rates for cotton for T-shirts and pants or shirts and pants typically coming into the United States at a tariff rate of 17%. Whereas man-made fibers come in at a much higher rate. So if you're coming through a traditional channel, it actually is more costly for man-made fibers or man-made fabrics or garments to come into the United States compared to cotton. So we tend to have an advantage there. However, if these goods are coming in through the de minimis channel, they're not going to be assessed or they're not going to have that tariff apply. So, you know, with cotton prices where they are, still trying to compete against man-made fiber, we're already disadvantaged. And you can also see, you know, cotton share on traditional imports is rather high, you know, 58 or 55% versus some research that we did looking at some of the web data from Xi'an and also Temu. Xi'an specifically, most of the cotton share there is very low, only around 10 to 12%. So showing that the imports coming in through these de minimis channels are not cotton friendly. They definitely favor more synthetics. And then lastly, the concern about U.S. cotton loss due to downsizing the U.S. textile industry. With the de minimis, it is going to be more of an import from overseas, specifically from China. So there's concerns about major customers of U.S. cotton in Latin America or even U.S. manufacturers who are going to be losing out on this.
And then there's the economics of growing cotton.
Cost of producing cotton has increased, and that's something that the producers, the farmers are having to deal with. And really, as we go forward in this presentation, it's going to be an area of focus for Cotton Incorporated to find ways to help make producers more profitable through both, you know, practices in the field, but also trying to bolster consumer demand and pull it all the way through.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I can say that this is an opportunity to show the power of collaboration.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking at the 37th Annual Conference of the American Coalition for Ethanol in Omaha.
As you brought farmers, you brought land-grant universities, you brought ethanol facilities together, you brought the NRCS and the Department of Energy officials together in a collaborative effort, understanding and appreciating that in asking farmers to take a chance and a risk in adopting climate smart or sustainable practices, that there's a cost associated with that, and that it would be difficult for farmers to take that leap without partnership. And that's why it was important for us to establish the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, as we did during the Obama administration, and then to essentially take it to the next level with funding under the Inflation Reduction Act, which acknowledges its two-year anniversary this month. You all have decided initially to start this in a relatively small area, one state or two. You've now expanded it to 10 states. You're providing resources to help farmers reduce tillage, to manage nutrients, and to utilize cover crops. You have expanded this program and opportunity to 167 counties across those 10 states. You've got the possibility of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of acres being committed to this in an effort to help 13 ethanol facilities make sure that it and they can comply with whatever the carbon intensity score needs to be able to take full advantage of new opportunities. You are creating a database that will be verified and measured, localized, and statistically significant, that's going to allow us at USDA to continue to build the database That in turn will enable farmers to take fuller advantage of market opportunities that exist under our ecosystem market effort. You are helping us essentially with a different strategy or a different route to underscore what we're doing with the Climate Smart Commodity Initiative, where we're also helping farmers with resources to embrace sustainable practices, to measure the benefit to the environment of those practices, and then to basically convert that into a new income stream in the form of value-added commodities and in the form of ecosystem market credits. And you're setting the stage for us to make, I think, a more powerful case that ethanol needs to be part of the sustainable aviation fuel future. You're doing all of that, and you're giving farmers a chance to survive and to thrive. You're giving us as a country the opportunity to do what we've seen over the last several years. While domestic energy production is at record levels, the only aspect of energy production that is declined is the amount of imported oil that's coming into this country. And you all are in part responsible for that. So a debt of gratitude. You're creating the opportunity for small and mid-sized farming operations to continue to stay in business, which not only impacts that farm family, but also impacts the communities in which those farm families live.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As a farmer, we're at a critical juncture. Currently, commodity prices will not cover the cost of production, let alone the extra monies to be spent in the community, hurting our rural and national economies.
Jolene Reason is a farmer from Ida Grove, Iowa, also president of Iowa Corn Growers.
A strong farm economy makes for a strong national economy. That is why a good tax policy is vital to keep family farms in business.
And was testifying last week at a House Ways and Means Committee field hearing at the Iowa State Fair.
So every year our Corn Grower Association conducts a member survey. We just got the results back. Over 90% of our members say that tax policy is number one to them. And we as an organization need to be focused on that. Tax policy is so important for our farmers to continue to thrive throughout the countryside.
And specifically called on members to pass a farm bill.
And I know this is a big ask, but please, please, please pass a farm bill this year. My dad. So I come from a family of six kids, and needless to say, we fought a lot. And my dad would always say, you got to work along and you got to get along. My dad's 90 years old. He still farms. So I want you to take that advice back to D.C. You got to work along and you got to get along. And I think I would certainly hope that we see some promise in getting that farm bill passed. And one more thing. You have a key cane there by you. You folks are the key to getting this farm bill passed, to getting these tax policies back on the farm for us. So please, I know that's kind of a corny gift, but it's so important, the things that you folks will do for us out there. So thank you so much.
While there's not much of a window for a new farm bill, there's a 2 to 5 year window for cattle producers. Dr. Darren Hudson.
We're in that weird situation. This has happened to us probably once in the last 10 years where we're at that bottom of that cattle cycle. But cattle prices are very high. But, you know, we're pushing a lot of heifers into feedlots. We're not replacing herds. Part of that's been driven by drought, you know, lack of availability of grass. But, you know, there's some real prospects, if you're in cattle, you're doing okay. You know, the reduction, the downward pressure on corn and other commodities is helping on the feed side, obviously. But on the demand side, you know, demand has been, you know, remained very resilient, even to the inflationary market. And so the offtake there has been really, really good compared with in times past where we've had way too many cattle on the market and we've seen challenging prices. You know, we're starting to see maybe, you know, as that grass comes back, a little bit of turn in favor of, you know, rebuilding some herds. We need that. We need more cattle in the market. But right now, you know, of all of the commodities, you know, that's the place to be. So I think going forward, you know, again, thinking, you know, 2 to 5 years as we sort of climb back up on that cattle cycle, we'll see those prices soften a bit as supply starts to catch back up. But, you know, in that 2 to 5 year period, there's a lot of profitable opportunities for cattle people out there in that market, be they cow-calf, you know, cattle feeding. And there's a lot of developments in that cattle market, too, of creating higher value product differentiation. The cattle market is trying to take real advantage of the position they're at right now. And the industry as a whole is moving us towards, you know, more differentiated products, more value added in that chain. So I think there's some great opportunities in, you know, that next 2 to 5 year period for cattle.
Texas Tech Ag economist Darren Hudson. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Farm real estate values continue to increase year over year.
We're looking at an increase of $200 an acre over last year, an average of $4,170.
Up 5% year over year, according to USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer. When land and buildings on farms are broken down by cropland and pasture land.
Look at crop land value. We're talking the average land value up to $5,570 an acre from $5,320 the year before. That's an increase of $250 an acre.
That's a 4.7% increase from 2023. Pasture land values rose $90 from the previous year. That 5.2% increase from last year reflects an average of $1,830 per acre. Meyer says while increased farmland values in 2024 are strong in the context of lower commodity prices and perceived unfavorable margins for this year's crops, they are not as strong as prior years. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.